Welcome back to the Zero Pressure podcast series, a relaxed conversation with those on the cutting edge of science and technology, hosted by me, Helen Sharman, and presented by Imperial College London and Saab. The Zero Pressure podcast series is looking at how science and technology positively can contribute to solving complex, interrelated global challenges of today and tomorrow. This time we're talking about the future of speed. Supersonic commercial air travel moved quickly from being a technology of the future to a technology of the past. And since the grounding of Concorde, there's been no supersonic commercial air travel. But with new startups appearing globally, is all that about to change? Supersonic flight has continued to develop in the defence sector, though, and as countries strive to develop hypersonic missiles that travel at 10 times the speed of sound, what are the implications of this speed for global security and geopolitics? My guest today is Conrad Banks. Conrad's the Chief Engineer for Defence Future Programmes and Research and Technology for the Aerospace Division of Rolls-Royce PLC, where he's responsible for new propulsion system technology for future military aerospace requirements. An aeronautical engineer, Conrad's career is based on engine performance and controls, and he's held various roles in engineering and management at Rolls-Royce, which have included projects such as engines for the Harrier and Eurofighter Typhoon aircraft, and propulsion for the Taranis unmanned combat aircraft. Conrad says, "My job is to get the best technology developed, so whichever platform goes forward, we're in a position to exploit and develop the best system." Welcome to Zero Pressure, Conrad. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Helen.
That Concorde, of course, I mean, it's legendary, isn't it? The first supersonic commercial aircraft to actually carry passengers.
Yeah.
With that similar-looking Tupolev 144 flying passengers for a few months between Moscow and Almaty in the 1970s. But Concorde's last flight, 2003, that's already some years ago. Why was commercial supersonic passenger flight abandoned?
I actually saw the last Concorde aircraft landing in Bristol in 2003. I remember it vividly. It's economics. It's economics, Helen. There was a very unfortunate incident in Paris that people remember, the crash of Concorde. And very sadly, a lot of people lost their lives. It was a freak accident, but the industry lost confidence. And it wasn't a viable concern going forwards. So British Airways, Air France, were losing money. And money is important in the industry. The aircraft was declined and services stopped. Now, at the very end, it was very popular. But I think Concorde never recovered from that crash in Paris all those years ago. If it was still flying today, I think there'd be lots of question marks about the environmental concerns of an aircraft such as Concorde and the drive for sustainability. And that's going to be a very important factor when we talk about the future of high speed.
So what do we need to overcome then? So start me off then, you mentioned sustainability.
Yeah.
If we're going to have supersonic travel commercially again, I think you're saying, are you saying that we need it? There is a demand for it, you think, again now?
Of course there's a demand. People want to travel at speed. It drives huge benefits to society. But equally, our planet is precious. And we can't risk climate change and other environmental issues just for the convenience of travelling across the Atlantic and the Pacific at 2, 3, 4 times the speed of sound. So we have to find that marriage where we can deliver a sustainable, supersonic, high-speed future with an affordable future. So we have to introduce a lot more technologies that enable us to travel fast and deliver that huge advantage to society that high speed will bring. There is a demand. We know there's a demand, but we cannot do it in such a way that we risk the sustainability and the environmental concerns of net zero.
So we're thinking about emissions, are we, in particular?
Yes.
For sustainability. So how do we make sure that those emissions are going to be suitably low for supersonic travel?
It's not just about the emissions being low. It's about the net zero aspect of that. The higher and the faster you fly, you actually burn more fuel per mile. It's less efficient. It's far more efficient to fly people in an A350 than fly people in a later supersonic aircraft when they are developed. So they are going to be less efficient. And the other challenge of going supersonically and at high speed is you need even more power density. So in Rolls-Royce, we are doing a lot of work on electric propulsion, hybrid electric propulsion. We've just tested a gas turbine that runs on hydrogen, but none of those are suitable for long distance, high speed flight because of the energy and the power density that you need. So we have to face the reality that we need some form of hydrocarbon fuel, and it will emit CO2. But that CO2 has to be part of a net zero cycle. So it is absolutely essential, if we're going to have a future in high-speed commercial flight, that sustainable aviation fuels, SAF, or better still, synthetic aviation fuel, that synthesized from water, from the air, powered fully by renewables. And in Rolls-Royce, we are looking at small modular reactors, for example, that are going to provide that carbon-free power, but solar and wind. Sustainable manufacture of fuel so that the carbon is absorbed from the air, and then when it is flown at high speed, it is put back. It's net zero. That's the only way this is going to work. If we dig up a gram of fossil fuel to power supersonics and future HiMac, we are failing society. It's just not acceptable.
I know when we're talking about rocket travel into space, it's not just the fuel, but it's also the manufacture of the steel, the aluminium. So presumably it's also about the number of times you're going to use each aircraft, is it?
It is. It's sustainability of the whole process. And you mentioned rockets. And rocket boosting, which is the way that a lot of high-speed vehicles and high-speed missiles are powered at the moment, those rockets are not really akin to a sustainable future. They are expensive to produce, they're very inefficient, and they are used each time and they have to be repackaged. So the future systems that we're looking to develop have to be fully air-breathing, and all the propulsion has to come from advanced gas turbines and from the ram and scramjets, and move away from rocket propulsion.
I mean, some rockets we can reuse. Elon Musk has managed to reuse some. So is that still not a possibility?
It is a possibility. But I think we need an affordable future. And if you are going to have rocket-boosted propulsion systems, they are still going to be very, very expensive. And you have the super rich that are buying these expensive, flights into space and in the outside of space. And it takes time. If an aircraft lands and it requires a rocket booster, you can't turn it around in an hour and have it fly off on another mission. Whereas if you have an air-breathing turbo ramjet, for example, you literally can refuel it with your sustainable or synthetic aviation fuel, and you can fly off again in a few hours' time, as operations are at the moment. So it is possible in certain niche markets that rockets have a future. I think for commercial high-speed travel, we have to look at conventional air breathing with synthetic aviation fuel.
I feel a need for some definitions, let's say, up front, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me the difference between a ramjet and a scramjet?
Yeah, absolutely. They're essentially very similar in that there are no moving parts, and they rely on the compression of the air in the intake to create the increase in pressure. And then that's just ignited with fuel and it's ingested rearwards. A ramjet operates up to about Mach 5, Mach 6. But in a ramjet, the combustion takes place subsonically. So that means the air relative to the vehicle is passing through at subsonic speeds, which makes the combustion much easier. When you go above about Mach 6, the air is compressed so much and gets so hot that if you slow it down relative to the vehicle so it passes through the vehicle subsonically, it is too hot. So above Mach 6, you have to let the air travel through the vehicle supersonically. So a scramjet stands for supersonic combustion. So it means that the air is passing through the vehicle at supersonic speeds. And a lot of the very latest scramjets that are being developed are actually combined cycle. They operate both as ramjets and as scramjets. So by modifying the intake geometry and the shapes, they can enable the air to travel through at different speeds. So below about Mach 5, Mach 6, they operate as a ramjet. It's easier, you can get the combustion to stabilize and you get better efficiency. Above Mach 6, to prevent the heat getting too hot, you have to reduce that compression factor and allow the air to go through supersonically. So the only difference, Helen, is that the scramjet refers to supersonic combustion.
So when do you think we're going to get commercial supersonic flight back again?
Supersonic flight, I think, could be relatively soon. But that will be Mach 1.5, 1.6.
So that, just Mach 1.5.
That will be the low supersonic aircraft. So if you like the Son of Concorde, the relatively small business jets, maybe up to 100 seaters, and they will be using normal gas turbines, very efficient gas turbines, flying on SAFs, sustainable and synthetic aviation fuel. Mach 1.4, Mach 1.5 will minimise the sonic boom, so they could potentially fly over land as well. And there's lots of aircraft, there's lots of companies, and if you go onto Google, you can see all of the competing companies, the Boom Aerospace of this world, that are looking to bring that forward. So Mach 1.5 up to Mach 2, maybe in as little as 10 years.
And we're talking then about sort of how fast across the Atlantic, say. Minutes?
That's going twice as fast as today. So that's 3 or 4 hours.
3 or 4 hours.
The step change is when you go to your sort of Mach 4, Mach 5. And that's absolutely in scope. And then you can cross the Atlantic in an hour and a half, even less potentially. That is very exciting. But that's when you need to start introducing, you know, ramjet propulsion, ramjet air breathing propulsion. And that's more than 10 years away.
So what do we need to do in that research? What still needs to happen before we can get to these really fast speeds?
Right. The ramjet operation is fairly straightforward. A ramjet is a very basic, there's no moving parts. You use the intake of the ram to basically compress the air and increase the pressure. And that's then mixed with fuel and that causes the reaction and propels the vehicle forward. But a ramjet doesn't work at slow speed. If you had a ramjet on a static test bed, you would get zero thrust out of it. So a ramjet doesn't really start operating till about Mach 3. So you have to get a vehicle to Mach 3 in the first place. And traditionally, a lot of the aircraft, the missiles, will use a rocket propulsion system. But for the reason I mentioned earlier, that has affordability challenges, that has the time constraints, and it's not really a readily available transport. So you need to have conventional gas turbine to take the aircraft from the ground and transition it to supersonic speeds. The challenge we have is that when you go above about Mach 2, Mach 2.5, you're really at the limit of what a gas turbine can do. And the ramjet doesn't really come in till about Mach 3. So you get this window where the gas turbine is really struggling to go any faster because it's getting so hot, because it's got moving parts in it at high speed. And the ramjet's not really producing enough thrust to accelerate away. So you have two choices. You either do a very advanced gas turbine that enables you to fly up to Mach 3 on a gas turbine. That's expensive. You need to develop a gas turbine with very advanced materials, very advanced cooling systems, very specialised for the mission. A lot of, and we've done work before. The industry does include gas turbines that fly up to Mach 3, but they're expensive and complicated. Or you have a fairly standard, affordable gas turbine, and you pre-cool the gas turbine. And this is where companies such as Reaction Engines have got some fantastic technology, and we are working with Reaction Engines on some programs at the moment. Where we rapidly cool the air that goes into the gas turbine.
How do you do that?
Well, it's a heat exchanger. Thousands of small tubes. And it enables, and it's just about transferring the heat. So you basically pass the air over an extremely large surface area of coolant. And that coolant will be in these multitude of tubes. And I mean, I'd say, I mean, I know reaction engines do a fantastic technology. I mean, 1,000 degrees to 0 degrees in the blink of an eye. This is what their pre-coolers can do at the mass flows that we're talking about. So suddenly a gas turbine, which as you get up to Mach 2, Mach 2.5, is really struggling because the air is so hot going into the main engine.
This is just because it's being compressed.
It's being
so much.
Compressed. And I'll come on to the physics of that in a minute. Because the air's being compressed and it's so hot, the compression system is already struggling because the air's coming in so hot. And there's very little margin to put more fuel into the gas turbine. You effectively have to run the engine throttled back before you hit the temperature limits elsewhere, and you don't get enough thrust. If you pre-cool all of the air going into the main gas turbine, you're basically fooling the gas turbine to thinking, hang on, I haven't got Mach 2 hot air coming in anymore. I've got nice cool air coming in. I can now operate as if I'm at sea level and put lots of fuel in and get the thrust that I need. So we're looking at the marriage of advanced pre-coolers, heat exchangers, to enable standard gas turbines to fly to Mach 2.5, Mach 3, potentially with a reheat system. And then you switch
to
your ramjet. And you can have a common intake, and you can literally have almost like a butterfly valve going, below Mach 3, the air is going to be passed through the gas turbine. I can take off conventionally. I can fly from any airport. I accelerate up to Mach 2.5, Mach 3. The pre-cooler allows me to do that. I then switch the intake to have a complete, simple, no moving part ramjet system, and that then takes off. So you now have a ramjet, a standard gas turbine, a pre-cooler, and you can fly from most airfields. You're operating on synthetic aviation fuel because it's gas turbine, conventionally powered. Air breathing, which helps the overall efficiency. That's the basis of your affordable system. No rocket systems, no need for having to replace the rockets after every mission. The gas turbine can be fairly standard. The pre-cooler enables the high speed from the gas turbine. And then by the time you bring in the ramjet, you've got enough speed for the ramjet to be in its element and accelerate away.
All this heat, though, from the air being compressed, it's got to go somewhere. Presumably it goes into the components of the engine, and also there's the fuselage. Do we have the materials that can cope with these high temperatures? And what are those temperatures?
This is where the physics comes in. This is essentially the challenge of moving at high speed. As I mentioned before, as a vehicle moves through the atmosphere, the air immediately in front of the aircraft, say at the intake plane, is compressed very rapidly. That causes the heat increase, and that's the challenge. That heat increase isn't a linear increase with speed. There's an exponential factor to it. And the exact equation is quite lengthy, but a very good rough order of magnitude is Mach squared over 5.
Oh, I love that. You know, this is going to be our first zero pressure equation.
Yeah. Now, you won't find this in the textbooks, right? This is the Conrad Banks equation, but it's actually 1 plus 0.2 m squared. But Mach squared over 5 is a really good approximation.
So Mach 5, that means the heat increases by 5 times 5 over 5, 25 over 5, 5 times more heat.
Exactly. So the temperature ratio goes up by 5. So if you're at, say, 30,000 feet and the air temperature is 250 Kelvin, if you're flying at Mach 5, the stagnation temperature, the temperature of the air when it's brought to rest against a vehicle at Mach 5, is 5 times 250. 1250K, 1,000 degrees centigrade. So if you were to have a conventional gas turbine at Mach 5, the air would enter the engine above the melting point of the titanium compressor blades. And then you'd have the challenge of, but I've got to further increase the temperature of the air to compress it and then ignite it. Way out of scope for a conventional gas turbine, which is why at Mach 5 we have no moving parts. We remove all of this rotating turbine machinery and have the ramjet. So that's the problem with the air that's being ingested through an intake. You quite rightly point out all of the air going around the outside of an aircraft, the friction. You know better than anyone, Helen. You know, when you re-enter the atmosphere, how hot the surfaces become. And do your Mach squared over 5 at some of the speeds that you're talking about there. very, very high temperatures. So you have to have very advanced materials. You also have to have very aerodynamic surfaces, because you want to avoid that direct stagnation of the air onto a surface. You want to make sure that the air flows very rapidly around the outside of these structures, so it isn't brought to a halt. You don't get this max squared over 5 temperature increase, and it's minimized as much as possible. You're always going to have friction. You're always going to have high temperatures. So my colleagues in the Airbuses of this world and doing the airframes are looking at advanced ceramic materials that enable effective transport at these high speeds and these high temperatures.
That sounds a bit like a space shuttle, the old shuttle tiles of ceramic.
Yeah.
So the way that I came back in Soyuz was we used a kind of an ablative material on the outside, which sort of used heat that we generated to disintegrate the material itself. So therefore, the temperature didn't rise so much. Now, I'm guessing we're talking sustainability. You're not going to have ablative materials on the outside of these commercial airlines, are we?
No, and we're not going anything like the speeds that we're talking about. So the two things we need to do really is to, as I say, is to minimise the impact area of the air over the vehicle going forward. So you have very, very sharp surfaces and leading edges, so the air flows almost seamlessly around. And the only time you get the air really stagnating and compressing is around the intake to the ramjet, where you want to create that pressure increase, because you want that to boost the aircraft through the sky. So it's a very streamlined aircraft, minimizing that impingement of the air on the structure. Where that's inevitable at leading edges, you have the very advanced materials, but you also have cooling systems inside, internal to the structure, that's taking that heat away that's generated on the surfaces.
I've also been talking with Dr. Kelly Stefani, Associate Professor in the Department of Mechanical Science and Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, whose research interests include hypersonics and high-temperature aerothermodynamics. Kelly is Associate Director of the Center for Hypersonics and Entry System Studies, and she serves federal and state government in the United States as co-director of the University Consortium for Applied Hypersonics. Kelly, what does high speed mean for defense and security capabilities?
Well, in practice, that means if we have a platform that is capable of traveling at such high speeds, it challenges the way that we think about responding to those systems in the case of defense. And it also changes the way that we think about leveraging a capability. So if you think about defense, there's a certain amount of response time required to be able to defend against systems. And if these systems are operating outside of the typical performance envelope, then we might have shortened response times that we have to now be able to accommodate. Or our systems that may be able to respond quickly are expecting a certain type of threat. And so these hypersonics platforms they're operating in a compressed time envelope, but they're also maneuverable. And so both of those come to mind when we think about how to respond to these kinds of systems. If we think about the way that these systems can be leveraged from an offensive side, you know, the compressed timescales also mean that now we have to, think about maneuverability or being able to leverage these systems in different time scales. And so that also puts a bit of burden on, you know, from an offensive capability, how we use these systems in certain scenarios. So both of them are important considerations.
I've read about a laser system to possibly, to shoot down these new hypersonic missiles, and another one about a space-based detection system. What would a good anti-hypersonic missile system actually comprise of?
Well, I think we're leveraging all of those technologies. So I think you're referring to HBTSS. There's also, directed energy concepts that are being developed. And I think it's not only the ability to defend against these systems, but also to detect the systems. And so I think that's the sort of layered or integrated approach that involves, space surveillance and other, maybe ground-based methods that can be combined. So I think all of that has to be considered when we're looking at defense against these systems.
From your perspective in your studies of aerothermodynamics, what's the biggest challenge that we're up against to develop a system that, I suppose, that works without us getting concerned that it's just going to disintegrate in midair?
Yeah, that's a great question. As far as, you know, robustness of these systems, I think obviously the materials are very important. So having materials that are not only performant under these conditions, but that can also provide performance off nominal conditions, that's a critical piece. The ability of these systems to respond in a challenging environment. So maneuverability, again, maneuverability in off nominal conditions, those are all critical path items. But then also it's just the vehicle's sort of self-awareness or situational awareness. So understanding if something is off nominal, how does that vehicle understand those conditions and then correct under those conditions? So I think that's, you know, sort of a longer term goal, but it's something that we have to move towards if we want these systems to be completely robust. One thing I would like to emphasize is, you know, we're at a point now where there's a huge demand and a huge opportunity in this space. We are absolutely relying on young scientists and young engineers to get involved in this community. And so workforce development right now is a huge component of what we do. And there's such a huge demand right now and so many opportunities. I would very much encourage any young scientist or engineer or any aspiring scientist or engineer who learns about these opportunities and who even listens to our discussion to absolutely get involved. There are so many ways for young folks to, you know, get engaged either through internship or, you know, other opportunities with industry, with government, with you know, any of our laboratories, just to reach out and to get involved, because we're looking for the best and brightest minds, and you guys are the future, so they should get involved.
Thank you to Kelly Stefani. And now let's go back to Conrad Banks. And we know how important speed is also for defence. And I'm really interested to know a bit more about that application, certainly modern times, and in particular the development of hypersonic missiles that I've heard a little bit about. I mean, but first of all, what's the difference between supersonic and hypersonic travel?
Definitions vary. We generally talk about supersonic goes from Mach 1 up to around Mach 5, and then hypersonic goes from Mach 5 onwards. There's no cliff edge. Some people talk about Mach 5, some people talk about Mach 5.5. Hypersonics were generally talking in the region of Mach 5 to Mach 10, and a lot of the defense applications are looking at Mach 10 solutions.
And is Mach 5, is it partly because that's where the ramjets stop being effective?
Yeah, I'll go back to my equation, Mach squared over 5. A ramjet operates by combusting subsonically. So if a ramjet is going at, say, Mach 5.5, which is towards the limit of where a ramjet can operate, the air has to be slowed down through the vehicle so it passes through the vehicle subsonically. So you're going at Mach 5.5 and you need to slow down the air to go through the vehicle to maybe half a Mach. It's got to slow down by Mach 5. That's going to increase the air temperature, as I mentioned before, up to your thousands of degrees. Now look at Mach 10. If you're going at Mach 10, 10 squared over 5, 20-fold increase. So that is 5,000 Kelvin. 4,700 degrees centigrade if you want to operate as a ramjet. That's way beyond the stoichiometric limit of combustion. You can't get any more heat release. You can't inject more fuel and expect to get much thrust out of there. So slowing the air down relative to the vehicle to subsonic speeds is just not an option at all. So at Mach 10, which is where a lot of these the sort of arms races at the moment between Russia, China and the US for these hypersonic missiles. At Mach 10, you have to allow the air to pass through the vehicle at high speeds themselves. So a Mach 10 vehicle will be going through the air at Mach 10, but the air going through the intake and through the vehicle will be going at about Mach 5 relative to the vehicle itself. So it has been slowed down by a factor of 5, about halfway. So rather than being at 5,000 degrees, it's at 1,000 degrees, and you can insert more fuel and you can get the heat release and you can get the thrust. But think of the challenges you've got now. This vehicle is traveling at Mach 10. The air through the combustion system of the scramjet is going through at Mach 5. So in milliseconds, I mean, people talk about ramjets and scramjets as trying to light a match in front of a hurricane, in the middle of a hurricane. It's actually way harder than that, because you're an order of magnitude faster than the winds in a hurricane. You have milliseconds to ignite the fuel in this supersonic combustion system, instantly light, produce heat and energy, which is translated as thrust through the back. That's the challenge of a scramjet. It sounds, if you look at them, they're so simple. They are just an intake and a fuel injection system and a propelling nozzle.
But it's all this electronic control, I guess, now, is it?
Yeah, that's...
Computer system.
Yeah, and... yeah. But they've been proven to work. So unlike the ramjet, where you are slowing the air down and it's going through at subsonic speeds, you're allowing the air to travel through supersonically through the vehicle, up to around Mach 4, Mach 5 in the scramjets. So it's the balance between heat generation by compression and the margin to insert more heat by combusting it in the vehicle. That's the sort of the sweet spot, the holy grail for scramjets. And that's where, you know, Helen, I'd love to live in a world where we didn't have to develop Mach 10 hypersonic missiles. I really would. But we have to be realistic with the world that we live in. And a missile, an air-breathing missile that flies at Mach 10,
that's got 7,000-8,000 miles per hour, something
yes.
like that.
Yes. Yeah. It's crossing the Atlantic in half an hour. It's phenomenal. And because they're air-breathing, they're quite efficient. If you look at the sort of the intercontinental ballistic missiles today, they're rocket propelled almost into the atmosphere, and then they go on a sort of, using their momentum and gravity, they continue on this high speed glide slope, but they have a very predictable trajectory. These future scramjet missiles, they are maneuverable, they can be throttled, they're flying at Mach 10. You might see them on a radar system, but they're impossible to intercept. So they are a very powerful deterrent. And I use the word deterrent because that's what defence is all about. We haven't got any active programmes in Rolls-Royce, so I'm only talking about public domain information here. But you can see why the technology is being prioritised to bring these forward, because a long-distance Mach 10 missile, it's undefeatable. And it, you know, aircraft carriers, naval fleets, they are just resigned to their fate when these missiles exist. So as a deterrent, they are something that the world is trying to develop, and you have China, US and Russia doing that right now.
Now, quickly before you go, Conrad, how many years do you think it's going to be before we actually see a fully operational supersonic passenger aircraft?
If you involve business jets, we say passengers, within the next 12 years.
Gosh, that's exciting. 12 years. Mid-30s.
Yeah.
Wow. Exciting.
And that's passenger paying. First flights well before then.
What maximum speed are we going to experience, do you think, let's say this decade, in the 2020s? I mean, in transportation, but also, you know, in defence. What's the fastest we're going to get?
Defence, the Russians claim to be doing Mach 9.7 today. Absolutely certain the Americans and Chinese have done equivalents as well. So Mach 10 in defence and scramjet capability today, that is happening. That research is highly classified. I don't know what's going on. I'm not involved with active programmes, but that's happening today. Mach 10 in defence. Air breathing, scramjet, probably rocket boosted rather than these turbo scramjets, turbo ramjets that are talked about. Rocket-boosted scramjets Mach 10 today.
Thank you, Conrad, for a fast-moving flight through high-speed air travel. I hope that's not too corny.
No.
But no, seriously, it's been a fascinating glimpse into not just the future of speed, but a real education, I think, into the science of trade-off and compromise. been a great pleasure having you.
It's been my pleasure too. I've really enjoyed it. And it's been great to meet you as well, Helen, so thank you.
Super. Conrad talked about supersonic commercial flights and how these are likely to be back in the next 12 years. The engineering behind hypersonic flight and what Mach 10 means for the future of geopolitics. There are trade-offs between sustainability, performance and affordability. And we've had our first equation on zero pressure, Mach squared over 5. Thank you for joining us on this podcast discussion. Do listen in to the upcoming episode of Zero Pressure Podcast, when we'll be talking about new materials and the material science that's enabling a more sustainable future. Not to mention how the natural world is being harnessed to make its own contribution to new electronic materials. Please share the podcast, leave a review and tune in next time. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Zero Pressure Pod. In the meantime, I leave you with this thought from Terry Pratchett in his novel Going Postal. Always move fast. You never know who's catching up.